It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In June, Phipps Conservatory and Botanical Gardens received a 2019 Pennsylvania Historic Preservation Award commemorating Phipps' 125th anniversary. It's just the latest in a series of state and national accolades for Pittsburgh's historic botanical garden. Richard Piacentini is the president and CEO of Phipps. Richard, welcome to the Confluence.
Great to be here, Kevin. Thanks for inviting me.
So how is it that Phipps, now 126 years old, is so often listed among those at the forefront of something new, especially when it comes to sustainability?
Well, we're always keeping our eyes out for new things that are going on around the country and around the world and really seeing if we can bring those back to Pittsburgh and figure out different ways to be more sustainable about the way we do things.
So is sustainability at the heart of everything you want to do?
It is now. It started back when we started working on our Welcome Center as our first LEED certified building that we really began to understand how human and environmental health are connected. And it really has spurred us on to really do some pretty incredible buildings since that time.
Well, let's go back a little more than a century ago. Remind us, a philanthropist, Henry Phipps, built the conservatory as a respite, did he not?
He did. He wanted a place for people to be able to get away from all the smoke and the smog in the city, a place where they could relax and experience nature and beautiful flowers, see beautiful things. And that was the original impetus for creating the conservatory. It's interesting now you look 126 years later, that's still the main focus of what we do, is to connect people to nature.
How do you put that concept of sustainability, that belief of sustainability, into action, though, in various projects, whether it's in structures or other activities?
Well, I think the most visible place where people can see the work that we're doing in sustainability is with our buildings. Buildings account for something like 40% of the energy we use, the water we use, the pollution we produce. So if you really want to make an impact on the environment, that's a really good place to start.
Speaking of buildings, the Center for Sustainable Landscapes, one of the greenest buildings in the world. Was that the intention from day one?
Sort of. We knew when we first accepted the Living Building Challenge that, we had come to the point where we were starting to think in systems, which is how nature works. And we heard about this new challenge that goes way beyond LEED Platinum. And we decided we really wanted to go for that. And we knew if we built it and succeeded, it'd be one of the greenest buildings in the world. It's interesting how when we got started on that, we then heard about the Sustainable Sites Initiative, which is all about how landscapes affect buildings and how buildings affect landscapes. And we decided to pursue that, and we got the highest certification they have ever given. Mm-hmm. And we also then heard about the WELL Building Standard, which is how buildings affect human health. And we were the first project to get platinum, which is their highest level.
These new additions, the Center for Sustainable Landscapes and the Exhibit Staging Center, they were designed with that Living Building Challenge in mind. What are the specifics of a challenge? How difficult is that to meet that challenge?
Well, they call it a challenge for good reason. Interestingly enough, when we first started it, we thought the fact that you have to be zero energy, which means you have to make more energy than you use and it has to be all produced on site, would be the hardest thing to do. We also have to be zero water, which means we have to treat all our sanitary water on site and capture and treat all the storm water on site. We thought that would also be the hardest thing to do. But what actually turned out to be the hardest thing for us to do was something called the materials pedal. Hmm. And it turns out that a lot of building products contain a lot of toxic chemicals in them. And it turned out that that was really the hardest thing that we had to do to make sure that none of those products got into our building.
Because you have to rely on somebody else to provide those materials, I guess.
Right. And, because we were one of the first building projects to pursue the Living Building Challenge, when we went to manufacturers and asked them what was in their product, we found out two things. One was either they didn't know or they didn't want to tell us. Mm-hmm. And it's now gotten easier than that because now more and more people are asking what's in the products. So manufacturers are starting to be a lot more transparent about what's in their products. And they're real digging deep to understand what's in their products. So it's getting to be a lot easier, but it's still probably the hardest part of the Living Building Challenge.
The Exhibit Staging Center was unveiled in May, I believe.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Any preliminary data so far about regarding the challenge?
Well, that building was also designed to be a zero energy building. So mm-hmm. it's completely powered by PVs and battery with battery backup. And it's also tied into our constructed wetlands, which means we'll treat all the sanitary water from that building on site. And it's also hooked into our whole stormwater management system. So none of the rain or any storm event that happens at Phipps on our lower campus, none of that water actually ever leaves the campus. It either gets reused or infiltrated in the ground. And that's, I think, a really good example of something we should be really aware of here in Pittsburgh. You know, we have the combined sewer overflow situation. Well, here at Phipps, we have an example to show how you can manage all that stormwater on site and keep it out of the sanitary system.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're chatting with Richard Piacentini, CEO and President of Phipps Conservatory and Botanical Gardens. How does that commitment to sustainability impact the lives of your employees, the Phipps workers?
Well, the interesting thing is when we started this whole Living Building Challenge, we were focused on the buildings, and we really came to understand that this is a philosophy that can be applied to anything. So we now actually apply a lot of the standards to everything we do at the conservatory, even in ongoing programs and operations, whether there's a building or not. And what has happened is that I think it's really started to, the staff have picked up on it. They've gotten very excited about it. And we've actually done some surveys that have shown that most of the staff have actually done things in their own lives to be healthier and to be more environmentally responsible. So it's actually having sort of an exponential effect.
So your impact is not just on buildings and the visitors that come to Phipps, but your workers, but individuals you're alluding to. And I think that's how maybe the Let's Move Pittsburgh program fits into it. You're talking about people's lives, everything from eating to getting moving.
Right. We got excited about the Let's Move program when First Lady Michelle Obama launched it. And we've been carrying it on since then. Initially, it was focused on addressing childhood obesity, but now we're really focused on children's health and look at all the ways that we can improve children's health in our region.
Are there any plans at this point to retrofit or maybe refurbish other buildings on the property based on the standards of the most recent sustainability projects?
We're actually involved in another project right now in Mellon Park.
Oh.
We have the Phipps Garden Center in Mellon Park, mm-hmm. which is actually the old carriage house from the original R.K. Mellon estate that used to be in the park. And we're in the process now of working on a plan to renovate that building. And we will also be doing that to meet the Living Building Challenge, WELL Platinum, and Sites Platinum certifications. So it'll also be another very green building, and a building that we hope that's going to really add value to the park and really make it. You know, Mellon Park is one of the most popular and most loved parks in the city, and we really want to see what we can do to really help accentuate that and really make it something that's valuable for everybody who uses that park.
You have spoken in the past about healing our relationship with nature. Is that a general principle you like to follow? Was it inspired by something specific?
It was inspired by when we started our buildings and really tried to understand how can we incorporate our buildings into our ecosystem around us and actually the watershed that we exist in at the Phipps campus, and how can we make sure that we do whatever we do is going to be beneficial to all the other species that we share our ecosystem with. And that's really been the thing that's really driven us forward.
Do you think that idea would hold as much interest, sustainable building designs and our relationship with nature, if not for the city's legacy of steel production and subsequently smog and pollution?
Well, I think what we're doing is a really great contrast to the way the city used to be viewed. The city's a lot better than it was a long time ago. We still have, you know, air pollution issues that we have to address, but we're moving in the right direction in most areas. And I think Phipps is a good example of what we can be and what we can become.
I think for many longtime Pittsburghers, going to the Phipps Flower Show might have been our first experience at Phipps. But you continue to create projects that incorporate art with flora. This summer, you added another component to the Phipps experience, Impressionist art, Van Gogh in bloom. Tell us about that. Why did you want to incorporate Van Gogh into Phipps?
Well, that was actually an idea that came through our staff. We have an incredibly talented staff at the conservatory. Most of the show designs that we do right now are from in-house, from our own staff designers. And that was an idea that they came up with that they wanted to explore. And I thought it was a great idea when they first proposed it. And boy, they've really exceeded my expectations, and the public too. Our attendance is way up this summer because of that show.
Walk us through the cultivation, the design of a seasonal flower show.
Well, it's different each time. You know, people don't realize that these shows are designed 2 to 3 years in advance because we have to find the plants. A lot of times we have to grow the plants from seed. We have to find cuttings or different suppliers that we might be able to purchase the plants. So there's a lot of work that goes into it. And we have a team of staff from various departments that get together and they discuss different themes or ideas, things that maybe somebody came up with on their own, or maybe they saw it in another garden on one of their visits to another city. And then they just start talking and start trying to figure out how to put it together. And like I said, they're really talented and they come up with some really great shows.
Talk about a couple of years. But so how difficult is it to integrate that living, breathing art into sort of a static place?
Well, I think the conservatory was designed for doing these kinds of shows. You know, you go to other cities, you go to conservatories, they're actually really tall structures. So if you were to change out an exhibit and walk into that space the next day, it's going to look dwarfed because of the height of the rooms. If you look at most of the rooms at the Phipps Conservatory, the ceilings are rather low in most of the rooms. So when we change an exhibit, it looks like it's been there for years. Mm-hmm. And it really helps make it a lot easier to do a lot of these seasonal flower shows that we do.
Are there any future projects, exhibitions, whether it's near term or maybe long term, that Pittsburghers should be getting excited about?
Well, we'll continue to be scouring the planet for different ideas from different gardens of things that we can bring here to Pittsburgh. And right now, we know we have our winter light show, and we've been looking at various ways to incorporate lights into various parts of the conservatory. And I think we're going to spend a lot more time on that because we have a lot more potential there.
What's one thing that you have on your wish list for Phipps?
Well, every year we've been going through and trying to renovate one of the rooms of the old original conservatory, and we're pretty excited about that. It's the most beautiful conservatory in the country, in my opinion, and each year we want to keep doing that, and I can't wait till we finish the entire conservatory. It's going to be fabulous.
Richard Piacentini is the president and CEO of Phipps Conservatory and Botanical Gardens. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski, still ahead on The Confluence. Homewood is one of Pittsburgh's poorest and most segregated neighborhoods, but it was founded by some of the city's most wealthy families. We'll take a look at how residents today are trying to rebuild this community. Then, high school and college students from around the country are spending their summer in Pittsburgh getting an up-close look at how cancer research is conducted at the Hillman Cancer Center. Find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, new rules are installed regarding prospective citizens of the United States who grew up in European countries that were remade into a new state in 1919. Federal Commissioner of Naturalization Richard Campbell said in a letter to the District Court in Western Pennsylvania that former residents of Germany, Austria, Hungary, and Russia should renounce their allegiance to those countries. The move came less than a year after the end of World War I, and Pittsburgh was receiving an influx of immigrants from those countries, eager to become part of the growing manufacturing industry. Between 1900 and 1930, the city's population more than doubled, and the newcomers brought with them some of the culture that still lasts. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, a weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. The heyday of the mall arcade may be gone, but video games remain one of the world's most popular pastimes. A Brookline organization brings individual gamers together and is rekindling a little bit of that arcade spirit. 90.5 WESA's Brian Cook reports.
The virtual worlds of online gaming have ballooned in recent years, and while gaming grows in popularity, you might say it's led many around the world to lose the common touch.
Loses some face-to-face practice of social interaction that is really valuable.
John Lang says it was an effort to reclaim that camaraderie and competitive spirit of same-room gameplay that prompted him, along with co-owner Ed Batston, to open Looking For Group in 2015.
I grew up with arcades. I grew up with putting your quarter up to wait your turn. You were always standing around a machine with four or five people, and you would talk to them. And at least some of that social aspect we wanted to bring back.
Located among the storefronts along Brookline Boulevard, the organization displays a modest business sign outside. Inside, you find a number of big and moderately sized monitors, video game consoles, PCs, and virtual reality headsets. The group is membership-based, but also open to the public most days of the week. Lang says the gaming can get competitive, and a little friendly trash talk is okay, maybe even encouraged. But he says players at Looking For Group, unlike some players online, are held to a particular code of conduct.
We don't let people say hurtful things toward each other. We don't let people use disparaging words at other players here, but also nothing sexist, nothing racist, nothing homophobic. Those words aren't here.
We have a very diverse crowd that comes in here, and it kind of brings them all together, and they all game under like one tent.
Co-owner Ed Batston says since Looking For Group opened, he's seen an uptick in the number of people eager to fellowship around both video and traditional board games.
Anecdotally, I can say that I've seen a change in our community that is for people that come in, they didn't show up with friends, it means that it's a little bit easier to like meet someone. You can like sit down at one of our couches and play a couch game. Like, I see there are three of you guys playing this game here. Like, can I jump in and be your fourth? And like, it's a way you can like meet people and make friends.
Some might consider gaming more of a young person's pastime, but according to the Entertainment Software Association, the age of the average gamer is 34. Batson says part of the Looking For Group's mission is to bridge the gap between younger and more seasoned gamers.
One of the beautiful things about gaming is that you don't have to be any age to play it. So you can be 15 and you can play with someone that's, you know, 50, just picking something up and seeing what's new these days.
Shane Tauber, a longtime gamer, became a member 1 month after visiting for the first time. He travels regularly over 30 minutes to partake in the virtual and social activities.
And doing that face-to-face, being able to smack talk each other right there on the couch, you know, you don't get a lot of that anymore nowadays. And it's nice to sort of get a throwback to, I guess you could say, the old days.
I'm Brian Cook, 90.5 WESA News.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The war on drugs transformed Homewood in many ways, ranging from the spread of gang violence to growing blight. In recent years, formerly incarcerated people have come into the community with the hope of setting the neighborhood on a better course. Our series, Homewood Bound, takes a look at how a community founded by Pittsburgh's wealthiest families transformed into one of the city's poorest and most racially segregated. We speak with people who witnessed the war on drugs firsthand. We also explore how individuals who have been released from prison find jobs and housing in the neighborhood. A range of efforts could turn Homewood into a proving ground for the idea that rebuilding lives can help to rebuild a community. 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley begins our series by looking at how the neighborhood has been impacted by racist real estate practices, mass incarceration, and the war on drugs.
Leon Haley turns a corner on a hot summer day and gestures to a three-story brick building. He beams as he describes the place where he'd stop after his newspaper route when he was a kid in the 1940s.
At the end of the route, I'd get my 10-cent cup of hot chocolate with marshmallows. Right down here on the corner of Homewood Avenue and Frankstown.
Haley has warm memories of his youth. He attended the now-closed Belmar Elementary School and graduated from Westinghouse High. He played kickball with his friends and went to the movies a lot. There were two theaters in Homewood, after all.
This was a very stable neighborhood, so we developed a kind of a community spirit here at Homewood in those days.
This is how a lot of people in Haley's generation describe Homewood: safe, intimate, and stable. The neighborhood started as a getaway from Pittsburgh's smoky downtown for wealthy industrialists like Andrew Carnegie and George Westinghouse. As the elite moved out in the early 20th century, middle-class Italian and German families moved in, alongside African-American families like Haley's. Although it was a racially mixed community in public spaces, pools and theaters were still segregated.
It wasn't where you were told that you had to sit as an African American, as a black person, in the back. It was almost like, that's what you do.
Hines History Center Director of African American Programs Sam Black says the neighborhood's major turning point came in the 1950s when the city of Pittsburgh announced plans to build the Civic Arena in the Lower Hill District.
So what it did was it displaced about 8,000 families.
Most of those families were African American and lower middle class. Black says they were promised money to help move but rarely received it. Some settled further up the hill, but others relocated to Homewood.
So you had multiple families living in them, packed in homes, what was looked upon as a successful business district in Homewood began to change because a lot of business owners left.
This all coincided with the movement of middle-class white families to Pittsburgh suburbs. As early as the 1930s, maps used to guide real estate investment suggested that better-off white families avoid Homewood and other predominantly black neighborhoods. Racist practices prevented black families from acquiring loans, and there were riots following the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968. Across the city, nearly 1,000 people were arrested, and more than 100 businesses looted or destroyed. In 30 years, the population dropped by more than half, to 9,000 two decades ago. Adding to the neighborhood's challenges, by the late 1980s and early 90s,
guns came into the community, crack cocaine came into the community.
Geraldine Massey grew up in Homewood, a neighborhood chronicled by her former brother-in-law, the writer John Edgar Wideman. Standing next to a paint-chipped peach-color house on Tokay Street, she remembers how the community was.
It started to really deteriorate into a community that you weren't sure about because there were people here that weren't raised. People that you didn't know where they came from, didn't know their morals or values, which was totally the reverse of the way it was.
Massey's ex-husband, Robbie Wideman, was put away for years after he participated in a robbery that led to a fatal shooting. Wideman was released last month. His sister, Letitia L., says his story became more common in Homewood as the war on drugs took hold.
You can talk to almost any child, and if their father is not in jail, their uncle, their cousin, their brother, every family has been affected.
I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
Tomorrow, as part of our Homewood Bound series, many residents of Homewood were incarcerated during the war on drugs. But after getting out, some returned to the neighborhood.
The reason why I come back here is because this is a community everybody forget about.
More on this series at WESA.FM/Homewood Bound. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. About 75 students from southwestern Pennsylvania and across the country are in Pittsburgh this summer. No, not for summer camp exactly, but rather to work alongside professional researchers at the UPMC Hillman Cancer Center. The Academy program started in 2009 and is still evolving. We're joined in studio by Solomon Lifshitz. He's the program coordinator, and two student researchers, David Donahue, an undergraduate at Carnegie Mellon University, and Rachel Rosenzweig is a rising junior at Poolesville High School in Maryland. Welcome all of you to The Confluence.
Hi, good morning. Nice to be here.
Yeah, how's it going?
It is going well. Thanks for joining us. Solomon, let's start with you. If you would describe the program for us, what do students learn? Who are they working with, and what are they doing?
Sure. So the Hillman Academy is a 8-week mentored summer research program. Students will work one-on-one with actual faculty, doctors, researchers in the University of Pittsburgh and the UPMC hospitals, particularly in the Cancer Center. They will be invited into those labs, and they'll be working on that mentor's actual research project. So these are all faculty working on usually cancer, and then they'll cut out a little portion of their research, and then the students will do that for the summer. And at the end of the summer, they'll present a poster and a presentation on it. By the end of it, they basically are almost as much of an expert in it in that particular topic as their mentor.
Well, that's good. Now, where are they doing? Is it multiple sites?
Yeah, so there are 6 sites and even more buildings. They are scattered throughout the University of Pittsburgh and the UPMC hospitals. So we have a site down by Technology Drive. We have one in the Hillman Cancer Center, one in the on Baum Boulevard by the Department of Biomedical Informatics, and then one's in Oakland's campus as well. We also have this year added a site at Children's Hospital as well.
So cancer research, are they seeing patients though?
No, these are mostly lab and dry lab research. So they're not necessarily seeing patients directly, but they're working with cells, they're working with computers and doing research that way.
Where do you draw the students from? Age range? How competitive of a process is it?
So it's a pretty competitive process. This year we had our largest applicant pool. We had about 450 applicants. And of that, we selected 75 students this year. So that gives you a general idea of how competitive. The students come from mostly Allegheny County and the Pittsburgh region, but they also are from, we have specific students from all over the country, as far as Hawaii. We have one from Texas this year. Rachel, for example, is from Maryland. And we basically look for students who they have to be at least 15 to be in a dry lab, 16 to be in a wet lab. And students who are interested in STEM, so science, technology, engineering, mathematics, they want students who are passionate either about research or to learn these fields, and we want to give them an authentic research experience when they come here.
David and Rachel, why did you want to participate? Rachel, let's start with you. Why?
I was very interested in STEM, and when I remember last year I was looking for an internship that would allow a rising sophomore to participate, and I stumbled upon the Hillman Academy website, and I was instantly drawn in by all the different research opportunities it gives students and how special it was compared to the other internship opportunities I was seeing.
David?
I think, so when I was younger, my sister actually did the program, I followed pretty much in suit. I had a lot of interest in medicine and biological research, and one of my teachers actually helped me get involved at the university and everything, and this was just natural progression for me, I guess, and this is where I ended up.
Were you interested in medical scientific fields? Is there something specific to cancer research that intrigued you?
I think that specifically working with patients is very interesting to me, but it's kind of hard to do that if you don't know any of the science. And a big way to contribute to actually helping patients is getting involved with research where you can ask questions and sort of make big changes. And you can't really get involved with patients until, like, you're older. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of where I wanted to start.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, something specific to cancer research that intrigued you?
To be honest, when I was first looking at the Hillman Academy, I didn't know how engineering could relate to cancer research. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad I'm part of the program now because I'm able to not only learn about it but also be a process of it.
Mm-hmm. Has the program to this point matched your expectations, David?
I'd say it's done more than match my expectations. I did it for 2 years while I was in high school, and this is my third year back as an undergraduate for the undergraduate version of the program. And it's honestly been one of the best experiences I've ever had, and is exactly why I am where I am.
Rachel, your expectations?
It's definitely exceeded my expectations. I remember last year I was very nervous because I was in Maryland, and I haven't been to Pittsburgh before. So when I came to Pittsburgh, I was surprised at the how organized the program was and how many students there were as well.
Solomon, as program coordinator, how's the academy grown in terms of students and mentors?
Sure. So in 2009, the program started as basically a faculty teaching five students about cancer research and having them work in the lab. Since then, the program has grown pretty tremendously. So this year, as I said, we have 75 students, so way more than that original five. Each year, basically because of the reputation of the students and what the mentors hear, we get more and more mentors who, you know, volunteer to take students. So something that I should mention is all of the faculty and doctor mentors who work with the program do it absolutely for free. They volunteer their time and their lab resources to help the students learn because they're both passionate about it, but also because our students have a good reputation as being capable of learning and interested in actually like a benefit to the lab as well.
Have you seen increased interest by potential mentors saying, hey, you know, my colleague did it last year. It sounded great. What about me this year?
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the reasons that we have the six separate sites. So each of the sites focus a little bit on a different aspect of cancer research. So we have a cancer biology site that's more down to the cellular level. We have a computational site that's more about using machine learning to analyze cancer and analyze genomes. So we, in those departments, have people who, you know, hear that their colleague has a student and that student was, you know, incredibly beneficial to their lab. And they'll come to us, the next summer and say, like, hey, I'd be willing to take a student as well.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking about how students this summer are engaged in cancer research at the UPMC Hillman Academy. Rachel Rosenzweig and David Donahue are two of those students, and Solomon Lifshitz is the program coordinator at the Academy. Solomon, part of the program about exposure, right? So the students work in different wet and dry labs. Would you go a little bit more into what differentiates wet and dry labs?
Absolutely. So a wet lab is probably what most people are familiar with when they think of a laboratory. You have your beakers, you have, you know, cells or some kind of materials that you're working with. You're pipetting, you're doing different work. A dry lab is generally more computational. So there's not any chemicals, there's not any cells, but you're working with that data and you're using computers and computer science to analyze that data.
Mm-hmm. Are you looking at the sort of the biology of cancer? Are you looking at immunotherapy? What are you researching?
So there's no single, aside from it all being related to cancer, there's no single topic that we teach, you know, for all the students. Because every student is in a different lab, almost every student has a different project. So we have an immunotherapy and cancer immunology site that focuses specifically on immunotherapy. We have a cancer biology site that focuses specifically on the cellular levels of cancer. I'm sure David and Rachel, who've been in both a wet and a dry lab, can tell you a little bit more about that as well.
Well, David, that's your cue.
Okay. Yeah. So I've only actually ever been in a wet lab, as far as that goes. But and I've also, for all three of my years, have been in the same lab because it was a great mentor. But I specifically work with how cancer and platelets interact with each other. So believe it or not, in order for cancer to spread around your body, they need platelets to do that. And basically, in my lab, we look at what sort of role platelets play, and we look at specific proteins inside of those platelets that aren't very well known to be inside of platelets and see sort of what role they play in those platelets and how it functions. So, yeah.
Rachel, so specifically, what sort of lab are you in now? What are you doing?
So This year, I'm working in a more wet lab. It's related to cardiovascular stents, and so I'm able to work on something related to cardiovascular disease. However, I was also in the program last year, and it was a purely dry lab experience, mm-hmm. meaning that my project was related to testing a machine learning program that analyzed how to accelerate drug discovery.
So is it too simple to say a wet lab broadly is where experiments take place, Solomon?
Perhaps. I mean, it's not that dry labs aren't experiments themselves, but I think more with what people are traditionally familiar with, like a physical experiment would be where a wet lab would happen, and then a dry lab would be more computational and data related. So there might not be a physical product that you're working with or trying to find, but it's still an experiment in research itself.
David.
Oh yeah, I would like to add that in scientific literature, we refer to different types of experiments as being like in vitro or in vivo. In vitro meaning in glass or in like some sort of petri dish, or in vivo being in the body testing. But like Now, a lot of what's discussed is research that's referred to as in silico, which means that it's processed on a computer. And basically, they run experiments on large sets of data, and they can comprise information from that using really complicated statistical analyses.
Mm-hmm. To both of you, Rachel and David, any surprises, things that you thought going in, boy, this will be awesome, but maybe turned out to be maybe a little tedious, or something you thought, this might be all right, and then it was actually fun, really eye-opening. Rachel?
I think sometimes in research, there's a lot of waiting involved, and I never thought of that going into the program. But I think it also just teaches me patience and time management skills as well. But one thing I thought that was pretty fun, and I didn't. Sometimes experiments can get kind of boring. But when I went into this program, I was actually surprised to find that it's not the experiments that get boring. It's what sometimes, if you're not interested in a project, it gets a little bit more tedious. But I've really liked the projects that I've gotten.
And what are you enjoying most so far, would you say?
Wait, could you say that again?
What are you enjoying most about the whole process, this whole 8-week process?
I'm really enjoying working along with my mentor and learning a lot about cardiovascular disease in the process.
Mm-hmm. David, briefly, what are you enjoying most?
I think the fact that, like, I've gotten to work with my mentor, I've learned a lot about how to interact with scientific data and ask questions and think about things in a very high-level way, and that's very special to me.
Mm-hmm. We only have a couple minutes left. Solomon, the program was created to better prepare a diverse cancer workforce. It's the 11th year now. Would you say the Academy is meeting that goal, increasing diversity?
I would say yes. So fortunately, we actually have we track all the students that are in our program. So in addition to, you know, while they're here, providing them with mentorship and research, we want to provide them with mentorship and just assistance generally after they leave. One of the goals of the program and one of the reasons that it was able to grow big is because we were able to receive grants from the National Cancer Institute Cure Grant and the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, specifically to offer stipends to students from underrepresented minorities. Mm-hmm.
The students are learning, getting an immersive experience, obviously, but how has the Hillman Center and the researchers benefited from the program?
So they're participating in the research. They're, you know, helping the faculty get mentorship experience. We're, again, you know, showing that we can diversify the field. We have a lot of students who are now going into college, graduating, and actually entering the workforce. A lot of them come back to the university. A lot of them will also stay in STEM, and it's just it's good for us to in a name recognition kind of way.
Very briefly to Rachel and David, at this point, might you be interested in pursuing a career in research or treatment, David, briefly?
Hopefully medicine at least, but I think that in part of doing medicine that research is an important aspect of that, and it's a responsibility for me to get involved with.
Rachel?
Since I'm only a rising junior now, I haven't decided my path specifically yet, but I definitely think research is very interesting, and I'm definitely thinking about it for the future.
Rachel Rosenzweig is a rising junior at Poolsville High School in Maryland. David Donahue is an undergraduate at Carnegie Mellon University. They're taking part in the Hillman Cancer Center Academy this summer. Solomon Lipschitz is the Academy's program coordinator. Thanks to all of you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time on The Confluence, we continue our series, Homeward Bound, an exploration of how a neighborhood founded by some of the city's wealthiest became one of the poorest communities, and how Homewood is trying to recover from the war on drugs. If you missed anything from today's program, or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.